dad, I'm an alcoholic. I'd like to thank the Occupy Committee for putting this on. This is a big deal. This is serious. And I've never been to an Occupy, Wacky Paw, Icky Paw, Snicky Paw, Schwicky Paw conference in my life. So I'm tripping on the whole deal, the whole young people. But the definition is if you have room to grow, right? So everybody's included, and that's very AA, you know? I just feel real honored to be here, and I'm really stoked to be here and share my story with you all. You know, I was thinking about, I always think a lot. Like, that's my job, is to think a lot, you know? And one of the things I was thinking about recently, like, you know, 20 minutes ago or so, was, you know, the importance of the AA story. And like the AA story is really the foundation of, for me, the meaning of the fellowship. And I don't say that lightly at all. Like, I really believe that. Because when I come into AA, you know, the last thing I want to do, I mean, I don't know what kind of meetings you all go to, but when I walk into a meeting and I sit there, you know, and there's like those moments of silence, like the person isn't moving the meeting along, right? And you're sitting there and there's like silence in between shares. I don't know how you guys react to that, but I get like really anxious, you know? And it's not that, you know, that giggly, you know, uncomfortable silence stuff, but it's like I feel a real sense of urgency about the things that get said in AA meetings. I feel like what happens in AA meetings, like we have some meetings are an hour, some an hour and a half, you know, some are longer, some don't have a time at the end, actually. I've been in some of those too. They seem to go on forever. But like generally we come into AA and I feel like I want to get the biggest dose of AA sugar that I can. You know, I want to get the biggest dose of what's provided here that I can. And so those silences for me are real difficult because I want to hear the sugar. I want to hear what it is you guys have. What you guys have and have brought to the meetings have been the foundation of me understanding myself in conjunction with working the program. You know, there's no way I could have ever known about the program had you not shared the meeting. There's no way I could know about walking through really, really heavy, nasty stuff in sobriety had you not shared that at a meeting, you know? And so when I think about the importance of the AA story, I think it is like this, it's this common thread that unites us. You know, all the stories are different, that's for sure, but there's this common thread of alcoholism in all of our stories. And for me, that's one of the main reasons why I come. It's a real selfish reason, and it's one of the main reasons why I'm here. I love the stories. I love hearing what you guys have to offer. And my story is my story, and I don't know how the hell to tell it. You know, I got to be honest with you guys. In my profession, I have this habit of, like, preparing before I go in to do my job, and I'll talk more about that later. But I can actually prep for my job. I can actually show up. My job requires a lot of public speaking. I can show up, and I can prep some shit. Show up and give a pitch, you know, and it comes off pretty good. And at times I can like look down at my notes and go, oh yeah, okay, don't miss that part. And I can gesture to the board, you know, I can do all these different kinds of things. And so I tried prepping for tonight, man. And I was writing some things down, like some points that I didn't want to miss. You know, I was like, okay, but don't miss that part. Now, that's really, really important. People like it when you talk about that one particular thing. You know, here I'm getting into the whole obligation game of, oh man, I sure hope my story is going to be good enough. I sure hope I'm going to be able to qualify okay tonight. You know, and as I'm writing my notes, you know, I'm realizing that like, I can't prep for this. I can't prep for it. And half a dozen people. You know, me expressing some nervousness, responding to me saying, you got one story, tell it. You got one story, tell it. You know, and that's such a great relief because that's what I have. That's what I bring in AA. I bring in AA my experience, strength, and hope. And I just feel so honored to have been asked to come here and present that. About a week and a half ago, I moved to Vancouver, BC, about 2 months ago, and about a week and a half ago, I got a call from a very foreign, distant voice, someone who I hadn't heard from in a very long time. And I picked the phone, and she says, this Adam? And I said, yeah. She says, well, this is Paige. And I said, Paige? Paige. She says, yeah, Paige Allen, yeah. Remember from high school? And I'm like, Paige Allen, high school. And in my head, like this bright yellow hair, like splashed in front of my eyes, just boom, bright yellow hair. And I went, oh, yeah, I remember you. I remember you in that crazy, bright yellow hair. And she was saying, well, I wanted to invite you to a party I'm having over Thanksgiving break. It's a 1986 reunion party. And I thought, man, who the hell is going to be there? And she started listing off all these names of who was going to be there. And all these folks that I used to party with, you know, these people that I had really, really heavy partying connections with for a long time. And I was thinking, what the hell is going to happen at this party? You know, what's this party going to be like? And it really got me thinking about my life and about my past and you know, frankly, a lot of the changes that I've made, you know. My drinking career is characterized, just like it says in the book, my drinking career is characterized by countless vain attempts to prove that I could drink like other people. And that characterizes my story. And so when she called me, I got this flash of Adam at age 16, which was 1986. I was 16 in 1986, with my Blue Liberty spikes that stuck off 12 inches on my head. I had a 40 ounce of OE in my left hand, a Camel Bear ass in my right, and I was sitting at one of these parties, you know, just out of the mosh pit or just somewhere, you know, just off the stage, sitting there going, God, it doesn't get any better than this. It doesn't get any better than this. And that's the way I lived my life for a number of years as a teenager, you know, as a teenager. And my, you know, I could go and I could talk about the first time I drank and, you know, the third time I drank and the sixth time I drank and that kind of stuff. But for me, it was really about punk rock. That's really what it was about. And I know that some people here perhaps don't care for that kind of music. Perhaps you prefer the country western genre. I can relate kind of, yeah, a little bit. So for me, it was all about punk rock. And when I got involved with the punk scene when I was about 15, it was for me the thing that really validated my drinking. And it's a part of me that still kind of resides. It still kind of hangs out. This punk rock in me is still there and very true. And I had a whole collection of friends who participated in the punk scene with me. And one of the things that I have always tried to do, how are we doing? Are we breaking up at all on this? Is it clear? Is the reason to clear? Excellent. Hey, this is great. Huh? I'm not a crook. I was too young. Fabricating that. I was too young. I don't remember any of that crap. But we had a whole slew of people who we all hung out with who were real committed to the scene. That's me, man. You get me on track with something. I hated school. Absolutely hated it. They tried to do everything with me. They tried everything to make me like school. They tried everything to keep me from fighting. They tried everything to keep me from running and chasing girls. They tried everything to just keep me to be not me. They tried everything. And, you know, they would pull me out of class, and they had these little gifted programs, and they'd say, well, we think he might be pretty smart. Why don't we make him learn some really, really big words and bore him to tears, you know? And that's really what I was, absolutely bored to tears. When I found punk rock, and I found the angry, naked aggression of that kind of music, I knew that I had a way out. And those things, combined with alcohol, formulated my identity as a young person. And really paved the way for my story, and eventually paved the way for my bottom with my drinking career. So there was a whole bunch of us, and we all had our own nicknames. There was my road dog was Little Boy, and we would just call him Boy sometimes, just for short, just call him Boy. And the thing about Little Boy was that, you know, like, Boy could be like 26, but he still looked like he was 14. And I don't know how he did that. But Boy still looks like Boy. And back then, you can imagine how much of a boy looked like. And he was my road dog. There was Little Boy. Then there was Beaver. There was Shithead. There was one brother named Spot. And his nickname was Spot because, you know, one of those collective, very, you know, intimate acid trip evenings, people decided that Spot, you know, that Spot looked like a dog. And he became Spy, and he, you know, adopted that, and like it was very real for him. He was in the 800 Club, as he called it. You guys know the 800 Club? The 800 Club means you've done that bad thing 800 times, and you're in the 800 Club. And he wore that like a badge of honor, you know. And I did too. I wasn't in the 800 Club, but I was working on it. the leader of the group, incidentally, was probably the guy with the slowest gray matter. the guy with the brain that was probably the most fried, who was by far the most punk rock, was Bone Dog. Bone Dog was the leader. And we worshiped Bone Dog. We absolutely did. He was about 3 years older than us. And Bone Dog drove one of those big old Oldsmobiles. It was a convertible. Just a total piece of junk. But it was just so cool. It was just so punk rock. And he had stickers all over his car, you know. And Bone Dog played bass. And Bone Dog had like 500 records of every rare, imported, unknown, uncharted, you know, punk rock recording ever made. And Bone Dog did his Liberty Spikes perfectly. Bone Dog would take his Liberty Spikes and convert them into perfect little rows, you know. And for us, Bone Dog epitomized a person who was not a poser. Bone Dog was not a poser. And that's what I most definitely wanted to not be. Does that make any sense? I wanted to not be a poser. I wanted to be authentic. I wanted to be bona fide in some way. I wanted to be real. And Bone Dog was real. And so we collected around this person, and we all became kind of real with him. And he was the kind of person who had these really deep pockets in his leather jacket, you know? He had these pockets that were like the size of backpacks. And his leather jacket, incidentally, was covered in these studs. They were just all perfectly done. The bands were painted on his jacket just right, and his leather was really heavy. And you could tell that Bone Dog was exceptionally cool. And he had these big old pockets that were the size of backpacks. And you never knew what Bone Dog was going to pull out of his pocket. You never knew. Like, you know, he'd unzip his pocket, and like a can of kidney beans would come out. You know? There's nothing punk rock about a can of kidney beans. I mowed over. Bone Dog, how could you do this to the scene, man? Those are kidney beans, dude. Those are kidney beans. You ruined the scene, man. One night, Bone Dog pulls out of his pocket a bottle of Robitussin. Who's in for Robo? Who's in for Robo? And yes, we embarked. You know, you got these little punk rock kids, you're age 15, 16, in the line of the drugstore, the little bottles of Robitussin, you know, waiting to buy. Yeah. And then one of those late night, you know, kind of philosophical moments, Bone Dog says, "I want to tell you guys something. I want you guys to know that you should never, ever, ever drink what kind of formula? Day and nighttime. Don't ever drink the day and nighttime formula. If you drink the day and nighttime formula," he said, "you will itch all over all night." And so, hence the story goes. We learn more and more and more from Bone Dog. Another thing we learned from Bone Dog was the punk rock way to get new shoes. You don't steal them. You don't steal shoes when you're a punk rocker. You take your old shoes off, you put those where the new shoes were, and you trade. And you trade. Bone Dog would walk in the stores, and we would, anyway, it goes on and on and on and on and on. And I love punk rock, and I love that life, and I love that scene. For me, alcohol, you know, talking specifically about alcohol, what that meant for me, alcohol was my absolute saving grace. And I don't say that because when I drank, all of a sudden I felt okay for the first time. Because, you know, I don't really see myself as somebody who had a real tragic life prior to drinking. And I will choose at this time to let my parents off the goddamn hook. I will take myself off the cross. I'll get myself off the cross and let them off the hook and just say, you know what, my parents did the best they could. They provided love to me, and nobody's perfect. And my family life was just that. It was my family life. And I really don't look to that, you know, that part of my existence to say that's why I drank. I don't look to that and make that conclusion anymore. I used to. My story used to be inundated with pointing fingers at them. But when I drank for that, when I first started drinking, what I noticed was that, you know, something was different. Something had changed. And one of the major things about that was my inhibitions. You know, I had no longer did I have inhibitions. No longer did I have these fears. of meeting people, or of meeting girls, or of just getting crazy in the pit, or hopping off the stage, you know? I no longer had those kinds of fears when I drank. And so alcohol for me was a salvation that I didn't even know I needed. I didn't even know I needed the salvation. But when I found it, I knew that I had found my home. And I would say that the moments when I drank alcohol in those first few years, when I was a younger man, those moments were some of the most spiritual, significant moments of my life. And I would encourage people to not look at the early part of your drinking as this big blacked out mistake that you should forget about. And as it says, you know, and I believe this, we will not regret the past. And for me, those moments were magical. They were magical. And it's what kept me coming back. If alcohol didn't work when I first drank it, there's no way I would have came back. Like, that's where all the other drugs as well. There's no way I would have come back to them. And I did, because they did work. My alcoholism progressed, I don't know, slow compared to some, fast compared to others. By the time I was 18 years old, I was drinking every day. I couldn't not drink. I had been in some trouble surrounding alcohol. I'd been caught at school with alcohol in my locker, and I was sent home, you know, which, like, I really cared about that. That was no big deal to me. I had done things at parties. I had begun to do things at parties that I didn't think I would ever be capable of doing, you know. My story is one characterized by moments of violence. My story is characterized by moments of doing intentional alcohol-induced harm to other people. And I remember feeling a profound sense of guilt about those things, because it seemed that later in my drinking career, you know, after a couple of years, it seemed like once I would start drinking, I wasn't sure exactly what was going to happen. I wasn't sure exactly if I was going to have a great time, if I was going to get into a fight. I was going to throw myself at some girl or throw myself into a wall. You know, I really didn't know what was going to happen. But I got to the point of my drinking and using that that I didn't see a way out, and my life had become very, very black. And I think that there's that moment that we have as alcoholics. And for me, it was a moment in which the thing that was my savior was at the same time my slave master. So my savior was also my slave master. And those two things coexisted for me. They were both coexisting. And that was a very difficult place to be in, because I would drink, and the Savior would arrive. The Savior was here, and the warm glow was back, and the world was all as it should be again, and I felt content and good in my own skin again. And then there were the moments in which I drank, and I felt nothing more than a slave. And I don't use these kinds of terms to be provocative, but I think that's how I would characterize those experiences that I had, that I really didn't know what it was going to be. And so I was real confused at that time. And that's a place where they say, you know, you don't know to go forward, and you don't know to turn around. You can't imagine life with a drink, and you can't imagine life without a drink. And it was at that place that I became real, real depressed. I became a real serious, I guess in my head, I became a very suicidal person. I had eventually, because I wanted to get away from drugs and alcohol, I decided to move to Humboldt County in California. I figured that was a safe move, because you know why, right? Well, the ocean was there. I mean, if alcohol got too close, hell, I just jump in, man. Moved to Humboldt County, and after one semester of school in which I completed seven credits and I don't know, a D plus average, I started having this really elaborate fantasy about how I was going to off myself. Because here I am, seeing my life kind of going from this happy-go-lucky punk rock kid to now this suicidal young adult who really didn't know what he was going to do. I was failing out of college. I had no job skills. I was really nothing more than a thief, you know. My major job skill, you know what my major job skill was? I'd walk into my dad's room. I'd look on his bureau. I'd see this big, fat wallet. So my skill that I had learned was how to open up that wallet and grab a few 20s out. He was my employer, so to speak. And so here I'm in Humboldt County, you know, failing out of school, no job skill, no prospects for a future, and so I became obsessed with this particular fantasy about how I was going to off myself. And I look back on that, I've never attempted to take my own life. and I'll state that real clear. I've never attempted it, and I know folks who have, and I don't compare myself to them in that regard. I don't want to overdramatize my condition. I won't do that. But what I will say is that for me, those suicidal thoughts were a vice. They were something that I had kind of attached to because all the power had been taken from me. I didn't even know it at the time, but I was experiencing in its real conditions powerlessness over alcohol, and I was reaching for some kind of power. And the only thing I really saw left, you know, was taking my own life. That was something that I could do. It was something that I had complete agency and control over. Eventually, I wound up in treatment, and I called treatment, my personal experience with treatment, my $10,000 big book. That's how I afforded treatment. It was my $10,000 big book. And the reason why is because treatment was a great place, and for 28 days, I got to cool out. For 28 days, I got to go to therapy, and for 28 days, I got to have a relationship with a 39-year-old crack addict. And for 28 days, you know, I got to eat 3 meals, and prior to that, I was only eating like 1. And for 28 days, I got to study all these books. They gave me, they give you a whole stack of books, the big book, and then there's like some pop psych book. I don't know why that one's there. It's not AA approved. It's some random book they give you. And anyway, you know, I learned a lot in treatment. It did a lot for me, but I almost feel like really what treatment did for me was it introduced me to AA. It introduced me to the big book, and it introduced me to the fellowship of AA. And as a result of that, at age 19, I was able to stay sober for 2.5 years. I had a real minimal commitment to AA, but I did see that AA had something that I wanted. The rooms of AA had something that I wanted, and that was girls. That was girls. And at that time, this is in this valley here, when the Ilana Club is in Medford. That's where I frequented those beautiful orange tables at the Ilana Club, where I had so many moments of blinding neon epiphany, you know. There was probably 20 of us who were between the ages of like 15 and 20. There was just a ton of young folks who voluntarily went to meetings. Like we weren't forced to go, we went because we wanted to go, and it was really, really fun because we all got to sleep with each other. And I really enjoyed that. To me, that was really what sobriety was about, because I don't know about you, but for like 2 years, it hadn't happened. You know what I'm saying? I got an AA as this social network of people who care. People who care. And at that time, you know, I was thinking about my commitment to AA, and I did have a real commitment to AA. You know, I think it's, you don't stay sober for 2.5 years going to meetings consistently if you don't have some degree of commitment. But it's a matter of how much commitment you're willing to put into it. And for me, I look at my life, you know, my dad was writing me a check each month. So my job skills hadn't really improved a whole heck of a lot. I did become real motivated after failing out of Humboldt State and became a 4.0 student at the School of National here at Southern Oregon University. Got really involved with school. But I think it's easy to stay sober and easy to stay in kind of a utopia with your life when you got people, you know, helping you with money or people helping you with your housing, people kind of letting you ride along. And that was a huge part of my story. And I will say this, and I just believe this, it almost makes me cry. And I know that it may sound strange, but the seventh tradition is one of the most spiritual things I have ever experienced in my life. The seventh tradition, when I truly worked it in my own life, I felt a sense of self-efficacy and self-advocacy that I had never even imagined I could feel. The seventh tradition, for those of you who don't know, is when it states that every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. And it was told to me repeatedly that what's really important about that is that I apply it to my own personal life. You know, but at age 19, there's nothing self-supporting about going to the mailbox and pulling out the envelope with the $1,000 check for the month's dues. There's nothing spiritual or self-supporting about that, and I lived that way for a long time. I stayed through it for 2.5 years. I chose at one point during that time to drink. And one of the reasons why I chose to drink was because I had committed myself to the social aspects of AA. I committed myself to meeting girls and having friends and talking the talk, but I hadn't committed myself to working the program. And there's a big difference there between the fellowship and the program. I think the fellowship will introduce you to the program, but there comes a point in the AA career in which the program the program needs to become significant for you. And if it does not, I have seen people repeatedly go out the door. Come in, great talk, the smile returns, they get the job, they get the friends, they don't work the steps. And I don't know why, folks, I don't know why, but they have to go. They seem to, I think 90% of the time, if they don't do that, you see them walking out the door, you know? Oh, it's AA's a bunch of bullshit. Oh, it doesn't really work. Oh, your sponsor's an asshole. Let me do all this crap. And I'm not the secretary of a goddamn meeting, you know? And they're gone. They go out the door. I got drunk, got scared, got terrified, came back in a week later. Nothing had changed in my life. Came back into AA immediately after that, because some people had gotten upset with me. And I wanted people to like me. Especially you folks in AA, because, damn it, I love you. Came right back to AA and got stayed sober for 2.5 more years. I retained 2.5 more years of sobriety. In that time, I had completed my undergraduate degree, and then I completed my master's degree at a university down in Arizona. I finished my master's degree. And all the while, not going to meetings, totally uncommitted to the program, but staying sober somehow. Didn't go to meetings for up to a year. And then one night, I was at a party, and I was going to parties all the time. I was going to bars and parties, and I was hanging out all the time, just like I was drinking, you know? And I wasn't drinking. It was really no fun. I was not having a good time. I go out to a party, people are drinking. I want to drink, man. I want to celebrate with you. I want to put my arm around you and socialize in the real sense of the word. You know what I'm saying? I want to socialize. So I'm at this party, and we're playing this weird game. I don't know. It's called some card. I think the card game is called Asshole. Have you guys heard of this game? It's a drinking game. I don't know the rules. I mean, someone could perhaps talk to us about that, but I don't know the rules. And I was drinking water. Stupid. Okay, Adam, drink. I mean, yeah, I was hydrated, right? That's not the goal. That's not the goal. The goal is to get dehydrated, man. The goal is to make your kidneys hurt. That's the goal. So I don't know what happened, but all of a sudden, it was the Budweiser Insignia plastic cup you get when you get a keg, right? And I'm drinking water out of the plastic Insignia cup. And I turned on my heels, I looked over at the keg, and I said, I'm going over there, man. Oh, man, I'm just going to see what happens, you know? I'm just going to show up. I have an AA principle. I'm just going to suit up and show up at the keg and see what happens. And lo and behold, the tap was like in the right hand, out of control, like a snake, you know, woo, right into the cup. And that night I yet one more time embarked upon a life of drinking. And that was the drunk that took me to a whole different place in my life. I started drinking that night. I went off to East Africa. I was going to be a Peace Corps volunteer. And I will say something about Peace Corps, man. Holy shiat. They like to drink a lot. And I say they, I mean collectively, like they are like a unit, a committed unit of drinking folks. So I am in East Africa, hanging out in these bars, drinking lukewarm Guinness. There's no electricity, right? It's all kerosene and shit like that. And this is like bizarro, wondering how in the hell I got here and why the hell I'm here. I have no idea why I'm in East Africa. I have no idea. Trying to speak Swahili, you know. Nina drew a key Swahili kidogo, right? I mean, I know just a little key Swahili. And my life, at that point, I knew that something was really wrong, that perhaps I had had real alcoholism. I had something that was definitely wrong with me. And the funny thing is up until that time, I was 25, I had never thought that I was a real alcoholic. I had never examined it. Daily drinker, blackout drinker, fighting while drunk, you know, acting like an asshole, feeling intense sensations of guilt, going into treatment, being suicidal, on and on and on and on and on and on and on. And up until the summer of 1995, I had never admitted to myself that I was alcoholic. And that is, I believe, a testament to the power of this illness, which is a very real illness. I look at AA like I look at the condition of insulin for diabetics. AA is the medication that we come and get and we use to stay sober. But first of all, you have to acknowledge some kind of problem. And it was in that summer that I acknowledged that. I was in this dirty hotel room with, you know, cockroaches the size of my feet. Literally. Rats in the corner. Geckos crawling over the walls. And people partying, I mean, literally, all night. It's like Reno. It's like Reno, where there was no electricity. Okay, so you got Reno. You got Reno. You got, like, you know, no public septic systems. And an all-night party. All right. I know. Shut up and get on with the story. So I was going to sleep the whole term, and I wrote down the things I wanted out of my life because I was once again desperate and really, really wanting to come back to the States so I could call and get Domino's pizza. I was bummed about that. I wanted Domino's. And I started writing out the things that I wanted for my life. And one of those was this kind of weird, unclear desire that I had to, like, straighten myself out, to become a better person, to somehow improve myself. And what was going on there was I was struggling with being an alcoholic. I was struggling with that. And I wanted to try to find somebody to get out of that. I got back from Peace Corps, and I quit early. It was supposed to be in there for 28 months. I was in there for, I don't know, 3. I quit early. Came back to the States, and immediately began a PhD program, a pretty prestigious one that I was accepted to. That I had declined to enter because of Peace Corps, but I had come back in time to enter this program to get my doctorate in sociology. And so I returned to school, and it was during the year from 95 until 96 that I experienced the true bottom that brought me to where I am today. And I spent a year there in school. I did really well in school, and I, for some reason, terrified, moved back. I was living in Vancouver, B.C., moved from Vancouver, B.C. back down to Ashland, Oregon, and didn't know what I was going to do with my life, you know. I would kind of somewhat quit school, and I was completely broke. And so I'm 26 at this time. I call up my dad. My drug and alcohol habit is so severe that I'm no longer able to pay any bills. I'm no longer able to purchase gas for my truck. I'm no longer able to go out. I'm no longer able to really do anything. And so I'm really, like, that summer of 96, calling up my dad. And I said, "Dad, I need to borrow $1,000. And 500 times. Out of 500 times, my dad has in the past said, sure, you got it. When do you need it?" And it was this summer, and I said, "Dad, I need $1,000. I gotta pay rent and a deposit on an apartment, and I just need the money real bad. I'm kind of low on cash right now." And he says, "You know what, son? I can't do it. No more. I cannot give you any more money." And in my head, I was thinking, "Jesus Christ, Dad, I'm only 26. My God, I'm only 26 years old. I'm still a student, Dad. Come on." And he just said, "No." He said, I'm gonna cut you off." And my dad has never given me a dime since that time. And since the summer of 1996, even prior to getting sober, for real, I call it, that I started working the Seventh Tradition. That I started experiencing the Seventh Tradition, because the Seventh Tradition for me is kind of a make or break thing. If a meeting fails to collect money, it doesn't pay rent. If it doesn't pay rent, I've seen meetings fold. And that's what the Seventh Tradition is for me. If I don't collect and sustain myself and provide my own sustenance, I fold. I will fold. There's a real fear of that. In desperation, I reached back out to Alcoholics Anonymous November 9th. Of 1996, a very close friend of mine took me to a meeting. I had since taken my master's degree and decided that I needed to have some kind of work. And so with my master's degree, you know, a really great-looking resume, been a college professor for 2 years, working on a publication, had professional presentations, you know, all these really nice credentials for the short career I've had, decided that I needed to probably go get a job delivering pizza. And so that's what I did. And so with my master's degree, I was the pizza delivery guy. I was the pizza delivery guy who periodically lived in the back of his truck. And so what I would do is at night I would drive out into the hills in the back of my truck, you know, here at this bottom, absolute bottom in my drinking career, the turnaround point, and I would drive my truck out into the hills. I'd fall asleep in the back of it, and sometimes when it would rain, you know, it's getting like late summer, early fall, like when it would rain, I'd put a tarp over my head, you know, and I'd be in the back of the truck with no camper and the tarp on the top of my head, and I'm really thinking, yeah, that's right. You know, because I was yet again defeating, you know, the odds. So I was this real triumphant, smart guy because I realized that if you really want to thwart the efforts of the rain, you just put a tarp on top of your head. That's all you got to do. This homeless thing isn't that bad. This homeless thing isn't that bad. And hell, I'm really not homeless. I'm just camping. I'm just camping for a while. It's getting colder, but I'm just hanging out, camping, having a good time. Canadian pizza's fine. It's fine. There's nothing wrong with it. It's great. And so after I came back in AA, you know, I was real desperate. I was broke and I was homeless and I was spiritually degraded to a pretty low level. And I don't know how much lower I was able to go. You know, give me a drink. Let's find out. Shit, let's find out. I can take a drink right now and go out and get a way better story. There's no doubt about it. I could take a drink right now and go ride that hot streak once again, you know? All I know is that I look at the word bottom and I think about a metaphor. The bottom for me is a metaphor for the turnaround point. And for some folks, that turnaround point doesn't come. For some folks, they don't get the turnaround point. And I don't know why that is. You know? I don't know why that is. I have heard people in meetings say that they feel like God has a mission for them. And they know that one of the reasons why they're sober is because God saw fit for them to somehow stay sober and help others. I feel like God has a purpose for my life, et cetera, et cetera. And to me, I look at some of the people who I've seen die. I look at some of the kids who are 15 and now are 32 who still haven't made it back in the AA and are toothless, homeless, and involved with dereliction. I look at the folks who leave and don't come back. And I got to tell you, folks, I can't in my heart say that I feel like I'm chosen. I feel like I have the very, very good fortune of being able to come back. And so I look at this thing kind of intensely. I look at it as a very special kind of gift. And for some people, they may need to do more research to get to the point in which they're willing to receive that gift and see it for what it is. For others, maybe they're ready. I've heard people in meetings in the Valley here say, you know, I hope your life is a nightmare. Can you? I'll steal this. What the hell? I'm stealing it. If you're new, I hope your life sucks. If you're new, I hope your life is at a complete bottom. If you're new, I hope that you are desperate enough to reach out and to try to find this thing. I really hope that that's there for you. I hope that you're at that place in your life. Because I feel like maybe if you're not there, you may have to do more research. And if you do more research, I don't know. I can't guarantee you're going to make it back, man. I can't. Just from what I've seen, I can't guarantee you're going to make it back. When I got into AA, you know, for real, when I became committed, I wanted one thing. And that major thing that I wanted was to no longer drink. I did not want to be rich. I did not want to have some great job. I did not want to have the dope girlfriend. I didn't want any of that. I didn't. I really didn't. Those things weren't even desirous to me because I lived this kind of derelict, homeless, degraded life for a long time, and I didn't want to live that life anymore. So that's what I wanted. I wanted to not live that way anymore. And for me in AA, I had a lot of real problems. I had some real problems in AA, and I didn't acknowledge those things for 7 years. I come into AA meetings, and I talk about how I was spiritual and how I believed in God and how I worked a third step every day and how I put my shoes under my bed, so when I wake up in the morning, I have to kneel and pray. And I said those things. And I never did any of it. And I parroted everything you guys said, and I showed up, but I never did anything. And one of the things that really stood in my way was that I didn't believe in God. I didn't believe in Him. I was an atheist. I thought, you dead? You wonder. When you're dead, you wonder. And the whole thing of life is nothing more than an irony, et cetera, et cetera. You know, Sartre and existentialism, all the depressing crap you can possibly throw on top of a book, right? I got into a meeting, I'd have been a week sober, and I was hurting badly. I'd still, my condition had not changed. I was still in a lot of pain and had not worked any steps. And I talked to this guy who had a time, about 22 years of sobriety, and he welcomed me back. He knew me from before and said, "I'm really glad you're here." I said, "You know, man, I'm glad I'm here too, but I am really concerned about this because I'm an atheist. I don't believe in God. I don't believe in this higher power thing at all." And I didn't, in the past, whenever I had, you know, expressed any kind of questioning about God, it seemed that people really wanted to just come right back at me and convince me. "Oh, but don't you understand? Reading the book, they talk about the electricity in the house and all that stuff." "Look, the electricity, you know, that thing? Uh-huh. Yeah, the electricity part of the book, yeah." And I'm like, "You know, forget it. You know, what are you talking about? I'm out. I'll listen to you, but I'm out. I'm not listening to that." And so this guy, 22 years after I told him I was an atheist, he said, "That's okay, man. That's okay. You don't have to believe in God." He said, "You don't have to believe in God to have a higher power." And I thought, what in the hell? I mean, here's a guy, a master's girl, you know, all this stuff, and there's this car salesman telling me, giving me an epiphanous moment in my life. Here is some everyday Joe who just happened to have 22 years of sobriety changing my life with just that very simple response to me. That very simple response is, "It's okay. You don't have to believe in God to have a higher power." And so I really became more receptive to ideas of higher power, to ideas of that. Today I will say that I don't consider myself a believer in God. I don't consider myself to believe in a being that cares for me and looks out for me. I believe, what I believe in today are my higher power, those are principles in my life. And I'm not different to anybody's conception of God, because the last thing you want to argue about is that. It's the last thing you want to argue about. But for me, compassion, patience, and tolerance became my higher power. And so for me, my higher power was action. And so if I felt in my mind that I hated you, or that I was sick of your crap, or that I was sick of the way you spoke in meetings, and I didn't like your car, and I didn't like your clothes, and all this stuff, if I had all that going on in my head, I'd reach my hand out and shake your hand and say, "Good to see you. Nice to see you." And that was my higher power, because it was action that was bigger than what was going on in my head. What goes on in my head is very self-centered. What goes on in my head is very, very childish. I don't feel like I have a real strong propensity to be a person who shares himself with others. And so my higher power for me was acting as if. And so for the first time, having heard the phrase, "fake it till you make it," for years, I don't know what happened, but for some reason that became true. That started working for me. I met a sponsor in that first month. He instantly got me involved with the steps, got me on track. The third, when I asked him to be my sponsor, one of the first things out of his mouth was, "Do you have some kind of service job in AA?" And I said, "No." And he said, "Hey, Bruce, hey, this guy needs to move some chairs." And like all of a sudden I just kind of, you know, got shuffled around, and I'm now moving chairs at this meeting. Then once a week I was committed to being at that meeting to move chairs. And it got me like in the groove of things. And what happened during that time was, at some point, I got swept away with AA. AA just kind of picked me up and swept me away. I was going to 4, 5, 6 meetings a week. I was meeting with this guy who was now my sponsor once a week, talking about steps, reading out of the book, and for the first time really working steps for real. And, you know, coming up this November 10th, I'll have 5 years of sobriety. I'll finally be, you know, 5, which is a milestone for me. Yeah, well, thank you. Oh, thank you. Thank you. There's a few things that I want to say about the steps, because this is where my life really changed when I came back in here, and I think it's really important, is the steps are illustrated very, very clearly for me in the first 164 pages of the book. And I tried to, like, get around the steps somehow. You know, I had this sponsor when I was 20, and it was time to work a fourth step, right? Because my step program was something like this. It was like step one, step two, step three, and then step 13. One, two, three, 13. Well, and that was how I did the program, right? And so this guy says, "Look, Adam, it's very important that we do a fourth step. It's very, very significant in your life. You have to do a fourth step. It will change you forever. You have to do it." And so he pulls out of this binder, this like packet of material. It's like, you know, this thick. It's got one of those industrial strength staples through it, right? And he hands it to me and says, every question regarding anything you've done in your life is covered in that book. It's covered in that little manual there. Everything you've ever done, everything you've ever thought about that was bad, every little this book apparently was going to be the ultimate instruction manual for the fourth step. And it was characterized by these little questions. Question one, have you, you know, ever thought homosexual thoughts? Yes or no? And on down the list, like sexual inventory, you know, thievery, any kind of odd perversions, bestiality, every possible permutation of the human condition you can imagine was in this little guide, you know? And I didn't do it. And you know, God bless him, you know, the guy tried to help me, and he said, what you should do is just do three questions a day. Just do three questions per day, and you'll eventually have your fourth step done, you know? And I know that person was trying to help me, but I didn't realize this, but the instructions were already all written out. They're written out real simple and clear. This guy named Grant, I don't know if he's still around the valley, but he said, we were hanging out at the club one day, and he said, you know, the fourth step really is the fourth step is a little piece of paper and a really big pencil. That's what the fourth step is a little piece of paper and a really, really big pencil. And so when I got together with this sponsor of mine in 96, I'm so thankful that he took me through the program as it was written in the book. And every time I went to his house to talk about steps or to work steps, we worked them right out of the book. And I from that gained a sense of commitment to this program that I couldn't have possibly had otherwise. You know, Hazel and Four Steps, Crystal Therapy, Patchouli Oil, Primal Spring Therapy. You do it. Go with it. I'm not against it. It works when you do it. But so far, what's worked for me was to work it as it was written out in the 164. One of the things that came through in my fourth step was I will tell you, I did not feel a sense of relief. I did not feel that like the cinder blocks were taken off of my back and now I was a more spiritually fit person. After I had done that fifth step, after I had completed that fifth step, what I realized was that, man, I really am screwed up. Man, I really am a nightmare and I can't deny it anymore. You know why I can't deny it? Because it's all right there. And not only is it all right there, but now some other asshole knows everything. There's nothing I can do. I was totally stuck. And in the book it says, after you've done your fifth step, you know, you're supposed to go take this hour break. And you just kind of ponder the sufficiency of what you've done. Were you thorough, it asks you. You ask yourself, did you do a thorough job on your fourth and fifth? Did you really get at anything? And after you take that moment, then you're ready to move on to step six and seven. For me, the major character defect I saw that stemmed from my fourth step was this sense of entitlement, you know, this sense of entitlement. And what entitlement means to me is that, so you got a great relationship, you got a nice car, nice house, I deserve that too. I want that. But, see, there's a little difference there because I know that you worked hard to get that stuff, but I'm exempt from that. I, for some reason, am exempt from the labor that gets you those things. I'm exempt from the work that goes in the relationship. I'm exempt from the labor that gets you the nice house, the nice car. I'm exempt from those things. Because for me, it was about receiving a check. For me, it was about getting pats in the back for really not doing a heck of a lot, you know? And so when I worked that fourth step and saw that sense of entitlement, I knew that I had at least some stuff to work on. You know, I started like really working on me a little bit. Since that time, I'm not degrading the other steps. I'm not bad enough in the other steps, but for me, man, that fourth and fifth was a big, like, it was a hard step for me to work. It took a long time. It took me about 7 months to write all the resentments out and do the sex inventory and the fear inventory. Those things took a long time. It was a very difficult thing for me to do. And from what I've heard old-timers say, they say that is the step that separates the men from the boys, you know, from the people who are perhaps going to stay sober and those who may not. I don't know. But I know that once I did that, I could see where I could work on myself, you know. Before I left to Vancouver, you know, I went from being a pizza delivery guy with a master's degree to being a professor at Southern Illinois University. And a full-time job with benefits and a nice salary and absolutely amazing students, a dream life. I was given, as a result of sobriety, a dream life. I had made interpersonal connections inside and outside of AA that I could have never foreseen. I could have never foreseen the closeness I was going to get with people. I could have never foreseen some of the successes that I was going to have. You know, I was this guy sleeping in the back of his truck. I was this guy who didn't even know what he was going to eat. I was this guy concerned about the bounced checks I wrote the night before to pay off the bar tab. But those were my concerns. And now I had these concerns with, like, editors and when the article is going to go into print. You know, I had concerns about whether or not the lecture that I did the night before was okay. You know, I had these concerns that were very, very foreign to the way I had lived for many, many years. And it's all because of AA. All I did was show up. That's all I did. I just got swept away by this thing. I participated in Fake It Till You Make It, you know. This atheist guy participated in Fake It Till You Make It, and I don't know what happened, but lo and behold, my life got a hell of a lot better. And when that first year of sobriety, my sponsor had me write down the things that I wanted out of life. And he said, write down all of it. Write down the Mercedes, write down the nice clothes, the girlfriend, all that stuff. And I wrote down all those things, you know. And I still have that list in my big book. And sometimes I'll open it up, you know, and look at the list in there. And the person who desired those things is not the same person that's standing here. It's weird. Like, the person who wanted those things that I had written down, I don't even know who that person was. It's like somebody else's desires. It's like somebody else's wish list. And today's wish list is so different. It's amazing. It's amazing. And even though I don't wish the big house or the nice car, I don't, that's not something that's on my agenda. The things that I do wish for, I think those are much more fulfilling and much more enriching to me. They do a lot more for me spiritually. And so by the time I had finished my tenure at Southern, being at Southern Oregon University, I had decided that it was time to actually finish school. I got the cart so far ahead of the horse, man. I was teaching all these classes. I was teaching overloads, and I was acting the professor, right? And I hadn't even finished my PhD, and that's a big no-no. You don't get that kind of job unless you finish the doctorate. Otherwise, you're a nightmare. There's no way you're going to get anywhere. And so I made a decision about a year and a half ago to move back up to Vancouver, D.C., and finish this nightmare called a dissertation. Finish the nightmare. So, you know, I cut off the hair, but you know what goes on in my head? When I'm speaking with my supervisor, who's not an AA, he doesn't care about sobriety. If he only knew my life story, he would care. When I'm speaking with my supervisor on the project, in my head rages the Ramones. The Ramones. And I have the Ramones CD out in the Jeep that I'm borrowing right now. That stuff still goes on today, you know? That stuff still goes on today, and I love it, man. I wouldn't give it up. I wouldn't give it up for the world. And so before I left for Vancouver, I got together with a trusted friend, and it had been 4.5 years since I'd done a fourth step, and I did a fourth and fifth with this person, who was a very dear friend of mine. And in doing that, I kind of was prepping myself for my trip back up north. And the fourth and fifth, man, it's just a sugar. I don't know if you guys have done it or what, but to do it for me now, the experience that I had was very different than the first time. It was very different. I didn't see these massive character defects that I needed to work on. I mean, I certainly have huge flaws in my character. I'm not by no means a perfect person, but it was like, it almost felt like I was just kind of cleansing myself, you know? I was looking at this business called Adam, and I was taking an inventory of it, and it felt really good. And it felt so great to go back up, to go up to Vancouver, where I had progressively hit bottom, and to be there as a sober person. And so in Vancouver now, I don't go out 4 nights a week to the bars. I go out 4 nights a week to meetings. And I got an Alana club 5 blocks away from my house. And this Alana club that I go to is off the hook. It's unreal. You're all invited. You come up north. You stay in my apartment. We got room for you guys. We got room. You guys come up north and check out the Alana club up there in Vancouver, B.C. Then they got a friggin' deck with like the glass siding, you know, like in the really fancy condos and stuff. They got a large screen TV. In the corner, they got these three computers that are all set up for internet. They got this cafe there. It's just off the hook. It's unreal. And the meetings there are just whipping me. There's nobody. First of all, it's strange. Nobody chairs the meetings. They start the meeting, they read some stuff, and then they just go, okay, what are the topics? And then they just start pointing from the audience. And it's all podium, right? And so people come up, And it's just, I'll go to a meeting that's an hour long, and I'll hear 25 people. It's great. I hear 25 stories every time I go to that meeting. And the first thing I did when I got to Vancouver is I hooked up with a meeting that I liked, the Wednesday night candlelight meeting up there. I got a service commitment to that meeting, which is really, really important for me. And so I just do what I did here in the Valley. I just do the same stuff, you know? And now I am effectively, gainfully unemployed. Absolutely love it. Not a chance of me working until January 1st. You could not pay me to work. You could not pay me to work right now. I'm having the time of my life. And I will close with this. I will thank you folks for giving me sobriety, for returning my life to me, and for saving the remaining part of what I hope is going to be a beautiful existence here on this planet. I wish you guys the best in your sobriety, and thanks for 12-stepping me tonight. Thank you.